Justice Bill Meyer, and I'll be your presiding justice this morning. To my right is Justice Bonnie Sutterth, and to my left is Justice Bill. We are your panel today, so welcome. And then, if you were ready to go, if you'd please call the case.
Good morning, and may it please the court.
Morning.
This appeal is from several orders entered by the trial court. First is an order granting summary judgment and dismissing Collins' wrongful expulsion, breach of fiduciary duty, breach of contract, defamation, and participatory liability claims, which are reviewed de novo. Second is the order dismissing Collins' promissory estoppel claim for lack of jurisdiction, which is likewise reviewed de novo. And third, there are a number of evidentiary discovery orders which are reviewed for abuse of discretion. In my time here this morning, I'd like to go through those three sets of orders. First, the summary judgment order. In St. Louis Railway Company versus Thompson, the Texas Supreme Court held that whether a voluntary association like a fraternity acted fairly and in good faith in expelling a member is ordinarily a question of fact for the jury. The record contains countless disputed issues of material fact that should be decided by a jury and not a judge. In addition, Collins introduced more than a scintilla of probative evidence to raise a genuine issue of material fact as to each challenged element of Collins' claims. Viewing all the facts and inferences in Collins' favor, the fraternity failed to meet its summary judgment burden to provide that it provided a fair procedure and due process under Texas and Virginia law. Now, Collins recognizes the deference afforded fraternities in the management of its own internal affairs under the non-intervention doctrine. But this deference does not extend so far to require this court to countenance, much less confirm, a fraternity expelling a member for hazing without the requisites of fairness and due process. The fraternity does not have unfettered discretion in handling expulsion trials and is not free to dispense their own brand of justice when a member is accused of the crime of hazing. One of the fundamental components of fair procedure is notice and an opportunity to be heard before a neutral and detached tribunal. The fraternity failed to meet even the minimum standards of fairness. Among the litany of unfair procedures in violation of Collins' due process rights, there are three standouts. First, the fraternity impaneled a tribunal composed of members with evident partiality and who harbored long-held resentment toward Collins. The record shows that several years earlier, Kaplan, along with two other members of the tribunal, demanded Collins pay thousands of dollars in attorney fees or tender his immediate resignation from the fraternity. Incredibly, the fraternity allowed Kaplan and these two other members who threatened Collins to sit in judgment at Collins' expulsion trial. The fraternity offered no evidence at the expulsion trial. Rather, it relied solely on Kaplan's own personal knowledge and testimony. From over 158,000 alumni members, there's no reason the fraternity could not have impaneled an impartial tribunal having no prior knowledge of the underlying facts. Instead, the fraternity allowed Kaplan to serve as a prosecutor, fact witness, and judge in a proceeding described by several witnesses as a sham carried off by a kangaroo court intent on expelling Collins with dispatch. Second, the fraternity impermissibly broadened the charges against Collins and expelled him on charges for which he was never put on notice in violation of his due process rights. Third, the fraternity failed to provide Collins with exculpatory evidence proving Collins' innocence in violation of his rights of fair procedure. The fraternity never disclosed the existence of the Thames report about his hazing investigation he conducted in 2002. Thames report would have significantly benefited Collins. Thames reported to the fraternity in 2002 the actual reason the chapter members were not cooperating with the fraternity's hazing investigation. It had nothing to do with with Collins, or what Collins supposedly said, it had to do with an ongoing criminal investigation, and the fraternity knew it. But Collins was prejudiced because the fraternity denied him access to this critical piece of evidence. Compounding this prejudice, the fraternity foreclosed Collins' opportunity to examine Thames about it. In fact, Thames later testified in deposition in this case that neither Colvin nor Chauvin ever mentioned any conversation they had with Collins. What's more, Thames testified that during his investigation, neither Colvin, Chauvin, or McGlinchey even mentioned Collins' name. And Collins' name appears nowhere in Thames' investigative report. The facts known to Thames constituted plainly pertinent and material information that Collins was entitled to prior to the proceeding of his expulsion. Yet all of this evidence was withheld by the fraternity. In addition, the fraternity refused to produce other witness statements referenced in its investigative files. The tribunal considered testimony by Colvin and Chauvin in a separate proceeding in Tampa, but Collins was not present at that proceeding and was not even invited to attend. Collins was denied an opportunity to examine any of these witnesses. The fraternity had an affirmative duty to provide all relevant evidence. Instead, the tribunal's evident partiality is demonstrated by its selective release of only information certain to ensure Collins' conviction. The fraternity also acted arbitrarily and capriciously by singling out Collins and choosing not to prosecute or expel other members who engaged in identical conduct, including Richard Walsh, Jeff Kearney, Richard Miller, Ted Lang, and Field Lang. None of these other members were subject to these types of accusations and expulsion proceedings. Finally, the fraternity failed to follow its own internal rules when it impermissibly broadened the charges against Collins in violation of his rights under the bylaws. A member's right to notice of the charges against him is at the heart of the fraternity's bylaws. The bylaws provide the alumni members shall be tried upon charges made in writing and shall give the accused member notice of the pending charges. The fraternity utterly failed to comply with this provision. The fraternity's findings against Collins went far beyond the original scope of the charges. Now, all of this conduct would be laughable if the charges against Collins were not so serious, involving allegations of hazing, which is a crime under Texas law. Collins is not complaining about mere breach of some technical aspect of the fraternity's rules. Rather, Collins has proved a wholesale deprivation of his rights under Texas and Virginia law and the fraternity's bylaws in a serious disciplinary proceeding. Collins is not asking to really relitigate the merits of his expulsion. To the contrary, Collins is requesting the fact finder to, number one, review whether the fraternity's procedure in his expulsion trial were fair, number two, whether the fraternity's decision was arbitrary, capricious, and unreasonable, and number three, whether the decision was supported by substantial evidence required by Virginia and Texas law. Now, with respect to Collins's breach of fiduciary duty claim, there are two types of fiduciary duties. One is a formal and an informal fiduciary duty and for fiduciary relationship. As the Supreme Court recently held in Ritchie versus Roop, the existence of an informal fiduciary relationship generally is a question of fact for the jury. Collins introduced summary judgment evidence establishing an informal relationship existed between the fraternity and himself. The fraternity was entrusted with funds provided to its members. On multiple occasions, the fraternity admitted that it owed fiduciary duties to its undergraduate and alumni members.
Is there a distinction between having a fiduciary duty as to funds and having a fiduciary duty as to other matters? I mean, are you taking the position that once a fiduciary, you're a fiduciary as to all matters, and it can't be segregated as to I'm a fiduciary as to holding monies, but not as to other activities? Well, because the allegations in this case is not money mismanagement.
That's correct. It's not money mismanagement, but I think that's indicia of the type of fiduciary relationship. That's what we have to prove is a relationship.
Right.
And that's part of that relationship is the holding of money, the close, long-standing relationship that Mr. Collins had with the fraternity, the fact that they admitted that they had fiduciary duties to its undergraduate members and alumni.
So you're relying as evidence of the fiduciary, the existence of a fiduciary duty on two things. I see, and if there's more, let me know. Mr. Collins' affidavit to that effect, which was attached to the summary judgment response, and the issue with regard to the monetary fiduciary duty matter.
And the there are a couple of letters. They're at record site number CR14.3651-2. There are a couple of letters where the fraternity admits that it owes a fiduciary duty to its undergraduate and alumni members. And so based on that evidence, plus Mr. Collins' 35 years of membership and service to the fraternity and his longstanding social relationship of trust and confidence, we believe that we have proved that an informal fiduciary relationship was formed, or at least sufficient evidence of such to present it to a jury for the jury to decide, which is what Ritchie versus Rupi, the Texas Supreme Court case, seems to require. The fraternity breached that duty by unfairly expelling Collins from the fraternity without providing him fair procedure required by Texas Virginia law. And as I said in the brief, context matters. You know, not all fiduciaries owe the same fiduciary duties. And an employee doesn't owe the same fiduciary duty as a trustee of a trust, for example. And so we're saying in this context, at least the fraternity owed him a fiduciary duty that they would provide him a fair procedure before expelling him on the grounds that they did so. With respect to Collins' breach of contract claim, it is undisputed that a contract existed between Collins and the fraternity. The fraternity breached the contract by failing to comply with the fraternity's bylaws. It impermissibly broadened the charges against him and then failed to provide him written notice of those charges. The fraternity also breached its bylaws by filing charges against Collins when only a member is permitted to do so. With respect to Collins' defamation claim, the fraternity published a false statement announcing to its members that Collins had been expelled for violating the fraternity's hazing policy, which is tantamount to accusing Collins of committing a crime. The fraternity's statements clearly fits within the per se category. Thames made a false statement that injured Collins in his office, profession, and occupation. Thames falsely stated that he called Collins, but Collins did not return his calls. The reason this is important is because Thames made this statement immediately before a call for the vote on Collins' expulsion. Thames' false statement had the intended effect of impugning Collins' reputation before the fraternity by suggesting that he was dismissive of the charges against him, was refusing to cooperate, and was not returning telephone calls, none of which were true. In Bell versus Expressway, this court held that when considering whether a statement is defamatory, the statement must be considered as a whole and in light of all the surrounding circumstances. Thames' false statement was particularly derogatory, coming as it did moments before the vote to expel Collins. When Collins was expelled from the fraternity for hazing, his reputation and good name within the fraternity were seriously tarnished. In addition, his expulsion foreclosed his involvement with a network of business leaders across the country. As the Warren Court commented, a person's good name, reputation, honor, and integrity are important rights that this court must protect. Collins offered substantial evidence to create a material fact dispute regarding his injury and damages. Viewing all the evidence and inferences most favorable to Collins, a reasonable jury could conclude that the fraternity and Thames made false statements that resulted in his injury. Now I'd like to turn to the discussion of the second order, if it may please the court, the dismissal of the promissory estoppel claim for lack of jurisdiction. In reviewing a motion to dismiss for lack of jurisdiction, this court must accept all factual allegations in the plaintiff's petition as true and must consider any relevant evidence submitted. In his petition, Collins alleged promissory estoppel claim against the fraternity based on its promise that it would not seek retribution against him and others. In support, Collins offered the allegations in his petition and his sworn affidavit, which were both admitted by the trial court without objection. The fraternity does not deny that a promise was made. It simply claims the promise was not made to Collins, but was made to the foundation board and the chapter instead. However, at the time of the fraternity's promise, Collins was a member of both the foundation board and the chapter. And despite its promise, the fraternity immediately retaliated against Collins and summarily expelled him within weeks after the fraternity made the promise. Therefore, Collins' pleadings and evidence established standing because he proved injury, traceability, and redressability. Collins was injured as a result of the fraternity's wrongful expulsion. The fraternity published to its members that he was guilty of hazing, resulting in his injury. Second, Collins showed traceability because his injury was fairly traceable to the conduct of the fraternity and not some other third party. And third, Collins' injury is redressable because there is a substantially likelihood that requested relief will remedy his alleged injury. Collins is asking that the court order the fraternity to remove its records from its records this black mark of expulsion so that Collins' reputation and good name within the fraternity can hopefully someday be restored. And in the remaining moments, I'd like to briefly discuss the evidentiary orders discovery orders. The first one I'd like to discuss is the conclusory affidavits of Wilson, Kaplan, and Thames. The record shows that Wilson testified that the written charges against Collins were made in good faith, that Kaplan testified he prepared his investigative report in good faith, and the statements made at Collins' trial were made in good faith, and Thames testified in response that he made his statements in good faith. And I see my time is up, so I'll defer to the next round. Thank you,
Mr. Cleveland.
May it please the court, Christian Tucker for the Appalese Kappa Sigma Fraternity and Phil Thames. Just before we get started, I'd like to emphasize a few preliminary facts that are involved in the lawsuit. Mr. Collins was initiated as a member of Kappa Sigma Fraternity at the University of Texas at Austin in 1965. In January of 2003, after notice and a hearing, mind you, notice of 30 days per the we call it the CBR, the Constitution, Bylaws, and Rules of the Fraternity. He was expelled for cause under the bylaws for three separate instances, each of which was subject to expulsion on multiple grounds, not only conduct unbecoming a Kappa Sigma member, but also for violating various orders, acts, resolutions, okay? So we're not talking about just being accused of violating a hazing policy. We're talking about two other instances also, violating a headquarters resolution, and also filing a lawsuit and pursuing and refusing to remove himself as alumni advisor of the TCU Kappa Sigma chapter. All three of these were subject to expulsion on not just grounds that they violated an order or a rule or a resolution, but also because they constitute conduct unbecoming a Kappa Sigma member, a decision which is uniquely subject to a determination of those who are members of Kappa Sigma. During the process by which Mr. Collins was expelled, he was afforded ample due process. He filed the actual notice was given in the end of 2002. His expulsion hearing was not until mid-January of 2003. Mr. Collins, after being expelled in, I believe, January 18 of 2003, filed this lawsuit at the end of, at the beginning of 2004, January of 2004, seeking the court's intervention in reinstating him as a member. Now, it's also important to note that the lawsuit itself does not involve the loss of a civil or property right or a pecuniary benefit. Mr. Cleveland alluded to the Thompson opinion, which is a 1908 Texas Supreme Court opinion that involved the loss of union benefits, insurance, free travel, railway travel, situations where we have a loss of a civil or property right. This involves the loss of a privilege of membership in a fraternity, not a property right. It's also undisputed that when Mr. Collins became a member of Kappa Sigma, he became contractually bound to the Constitution, bylaws, and rules of the fraternity. And those Constitution, bylaws, and rules specifically set forth the procedure by which Mr. Collins was expelled. And it included ample notice and a hearing, an opportunity to defend himself. And as you recall from reading the facts, Mr. Collins had enough time not only to hire Darrell Keith, but also to write a 10-plus page defense letter supported by three affidavits that was read at his hearing and considered. The evidence provided to Mr. Collins is also in the record, and we cite to it in our brief on pages 3 through 5 of his statement of facts. The procedure that was afforded Mr. Collins is outlined on pages 2 through 11 of Appellee's brief. It is extremely detailed. This is not a situation where Mr. Collins was called up after the fact and told that he was expelled. There was a tremendous amount of due process afforded Mr. Collins, and there's ample evidence to support the decision to expel him on multiple grounds. In a situation like this, as the court is aware and is set forth in Whitmire, judicial review is only proper when the actions of the organization are shown to be illegal, against public policy, arbitrary, or capricious. The burden is on Mr. Collins to establish one of these limited exceptions. Courts in this type of situation focus on the process. They do not interfere with the merits of the decision when there is evidence to support it. There is ample evidence to support the decision in this case. The process, as I already indicated, is set forth on pages 2 through 11 of Appellee's brief. As far as the issue of alleging good faith or alleging bad faith or partiality, that is not enough. How does partiality or bias manifest itself? One has to ask. It's in lack of evidence to support the decision. In this case, the evidence supports the decision. In those types of situations, courts do not interfere. They're by definition not arbitrary or capricious. If it was sufficient to allege bad faith or partiality to get a court to intervene in a social organization's determination of the privilege of membership, there would be no finality to those decisions, because every case would involve an allegation that the guys that voted me out did not like me. That's not enough. And you have to look at the evidence that supports the decision. If it's there, you defer to the organization. Again, we do not have a situation involving the loss of a tangible property right, not insurance, not some kind of benefits. Mr. Collins spends a great bit of his brief re-arguing the underlying merits of the case. That is not what we're here to decide today. The focus is on the process. And as I've already explained, that is extremely detailed and was performed in compliance with the Constitution, bylaws, and rules that Mr. Collins was contractually bound to. Another case that Mr. Collins relies on is the Gibson case, advocating the notion that you need some kind of extreme super due process anytime you have a membership decision. Well, the Gibson case is important to note, involved a situation where the Boy Scouts expelled a troop leader without notice or a hearing. We don't have that situation here. It was also involved a situation where there was no written procedure. We have a written procedure here. It's in the Kappa Sigma bylaws, Constitution bylaws and rules. It was also a situation where the parties themselves, if you read the underlying district court opinion, submitted their idea of what a fair procedure was. We have no idea of knowing what they agreed to. We just know what the court ultimately determined was a fair procedure. This situation involves a procedure that Mr. Collins agreed to already and was complied with, and include ample notice and an opportunity to be heard. One other thing to note about Gibson. In Gibson, the remedy was not reinstatement for failure to provide fair procedure. The remedy was to tell the Boy Scouts to redo it, to do it over again pursuant to this procedure. So even under what Mr. Collins is advocating, the most that the court could do under that would be to go back and say, all right, Kappa Sigma, you didn't do it the right way. This is the way you should have done it. And have him redetermine whether or not Mr. Collins violated the things that Kappa Sigma already said he violated. Mr. Collins indicates somehow that he was singled out, that others committed acts. Again, this again goes to the underlying merits. But putting that aside, whether or not Mr. Collins was singled out for being the only one who violated the hazing policy or being the only one that opposed the fraternity on a headquarters resolution to save the headquarters is irrelevant. The fact of the matter is that the conduct occurred. If I run a stop sign and 100 other people run the same stop sign and I'm the only one that gets a ticket, does that mean I didn't run the stop sign? No, I get a ticket anyway.
Mr. Christian, were there any other members of the fraternity charged with violation of rules that could result in the expulsion in this transaction, any of these transactions that are the basis of the claim violations by the Kappa Sig fraternity?
As far as the record shows, I don't know if the record shows that any were.
That's the reason I ask you.
Right. My understanding is that there were subsequent charges against others, not for specifically all three of these things, but for that, like Mr. Kearney was not charged on the allegation of a hazing policy.
He's been a good corporate attorney, wasn't he?
Well, he was representing the criminal. Yeah, I mean he was their criminal
defense lawyer. Attorney.
Right. On the headquarters resolution, I'm not sure if any of the other individuals that participated in the lawsuit opposing the fraternity trying to prevent the sale of its headquarters, if any of those were subsequently pursued.
About the University of Texas in the Tall situation.
The Tall situation was not a part of the charges. That was a separate. The three charges involved the alumni advisor lawsuit, the headquarters resolution, and the hazing policy violation.
Right.
So as far as the TOS chapter goes, I don't know if anyone in that situation was pursued or not. I am aware that some other individuals were subsequently expelled. I don't know specifically what the charges were, but they all kind of, to be honest with you, I don't want to mislead you to think
that. It's not in the record. I was only asking you about the record.
Yeah.
If you knew of some place that I missed where it
right.
showed that anyone else was the subject of either a claim violation of orders that caused enough concern that charges to expel them from the fraternity were filed.
Right. I think that it's safe to say that Mr. Collins is in a league of his own when it comes to all three. There were others that may have committed one act or two acts, but not all three. There's a reason why we're here today because Mr. Collins has indicated a history, as seen by the record, of being opposite the fraternity's best interests and what the fraternity feels its best interests are. And it's manifested itself in the charges that were brought against him, and the evidence supports it. As far as the notion that you need substantial evidence to support the decision, again, that substantial evidence argument is based on cases in which there was a loss of a property right, a pecuniary benefit, whether it be insurance, again, health, life, pension benefits, things of that nature. Going to the issue of the existence of a fiduciary relationship, actually the lack of the existence of a fiduciary relationship, there's absolutely no authority in the record to support the notion that a fraternity owes each individual member of its organization a fiduciary duty, formal or informal. As far as the notion that somehow the fraternity admitted it owed a fiduciary duty to its members, if you look at those letters themselves, they're not probative of anything. First of all, the question is a question of law. Second of all, they're obviously talking about owing a fiduciary duty to the fraternity as a whole, not to one individual member. It makes no sense. Functionally, it makes no sense because you can't put the interests of one individual over the interests of the organization as a whole. There was one case cited, Sasson, that involved a principal-agent relationship where in the declaration, the condo association was appointed attorney-in-fact for the homeowners or the condo owners. That was not some claim or some situation where the court held a fiduciary relationship existed just by virtue of that relationship. There was actually a declaration appointing the condo association as attorney in fact, which, as we know, creates a fiduciary relationship.
At one point in your argument, you argue that these allegedly defamatory statements were privileged because there was no malice.
Correct.
Isn't the question of whether there was malice, number one, a fact issue, and number two, the burden is on you to prove that?
I believe that is correct, Your Honor, but I think the main point on the defamation is that, especially as it relates to Mr. Thames, saying somebody doesn't return my phone calls in the context of a fraternity inquiry is not defamatory. If you look at the case law, it doesn't subject someone to that kind of contempt, hatred, ridicule that rises to the level of defamation.
Don't they also argue that defamation occurred with regard to the publication?
The publication of the charges, and again, Your Honor, I think our argument on that is there's no evidence of damages. And again, it's a situation where he hasn't been accused of a crime. This is a charge that he violated a hazing policy that's set out. It's cited.
The hazing policy, does it differ in any way from state law on hazing?
I don't believe that the
is
hazing...
Is it one and the same? I mean, if you violate the hazing policy, have you violated state law?
Are they two
different standards?
I don't believe... May I finish?
Mm-hmm.
I don't believe that's the case, Your Honor, because the hazing policy, I think, is broader. I think the way it's worded, it's broader than what state law would indicate. I don't have that penal statute memorized, but it involved knowledge and just actually knowing about a hazing violation and a duty to report it, not someone who's out actually physically beating a pledge or, you know, a situation where someone's forcing someone to drink an excessive amount of alcohol. I think the hazing policy itself for Kappa Sig was broader than that.
Thank you, Mr. Christian.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. just to address your question, hazing statute is Texas Education Code 37.152, and it provides that a person commits an offense if the person engages in hazing, solicits, encourages, directs, or attempts to, or aids another in engaging in hazing, has firsthand knowledge of the planning of a specific hazing incident, or knowingly fails to report that knowledge in writing to appropriate officials. So it's almost identical to the hazing policy that the Kappa Sig adopted. So that's the answer to your question on that. The the alumni advisor allegation, that was a six-year-old claim that they dredged up to bring into this expulsion proceeding. And what's galling about that is the fraternity admitted in a Texas court before Judge Barton that Mr. Collins' participation in that lawsuit was not conduct unbecoming a member. And they charge him for it anyway 6 years later. That's the galling thing about this. And Richard Walsh, who was the person who originally brought this lawsuit, Mr. Collins did not bring the lawsuit against the fraternity. Richard Walsh brought the lawsuit. And to answer your question, Justice Meyer, Richard Walsh was not terminated or expelled for bringing the lawsuit. Nothing happened to him. Yet they targeted Collins for this vituperative treatment. Now, there's another argument that Mr. Tucker made that there's no civil or tangible property right involved in this case. And first of all, I'd like to say that this was not addressed at the court below, nor in any of the briefing to this court. And I consider it waived. But even if it's not, I mean, there's an assortment of cases that I question whether there's any property right at all. For example, in Hatley, the Fifth Circuit opinion, there was a colt registration was refused because of the white markings were below the lines of the prescribed rules. In Eastern Star, in this court, there was an issue. A person was expelled from the Eastern Star society because in the only identifiable property right involved was a $600 insurance payment. In Warren versus National Association of Public School Principals, a kid was dismissed from the Honor Society for drinking beer at a Pizza Hut. And there was an order entered in that case of a permanent injunction in expunging the record because of the due process violation. So If there is a property or civil tangible property right argument that they did not waive, it doesn't take a whole lot to get there. And I'm reminded of the fact what the Warren Court held is that a person's good name, reputation, honor, integrity are important rights that must be protected by the courts of this country. And there was a, then Mr. Tucker also said, well, there you can't prove that there was any evident partiality. There's no requirement that they be absolutely unbiased, but the evident partiality is demonstrated by the fact that they refused to provide him information to that would exonerate him. That's evident. That's evidence of evident partiality. So if the court has any other further questions, I'll turn over the remaining.
I have one question. With regard to the contract issue, breach of contract, where in the record are there any evidence of contractual damages?
The contractual damages would be the same that we've alleged for the defamation and the breach of fiduciary duty claim, and that's in Collins' affidavit. I believe it's paragraphs 94 and 95 of his affidavit where he sets forth what he believes are his damages for the expulsion that he received in violation of his due process rights.
Thank you.
I just close by saying, due to the countless issues of disputed material facts in this case is the most unlikely candidate for summary disposition. Collins deserves a trial so he can prove once and for all that the fraternity failed to afford him a fair procedure and due process under Texas or Virginia law. Collins did not get a fair procedure or due process at the fraternity's show trial in San Diego, California at the DoubleTree Hotel. He deserves a fair trial in Texas. We respectfully request the judgment be reversed and the case be remanded for a long overdue trial. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel, and you too, Mr. Christian. This case has been a very well litigated in the Court of Appeals and very well briefed and presented. And all of us thank you for your job that you've done here. And with that statement, I'll say that this hearing is closed and your case is submitted, and you'll hear from us in the written opinion. Thank you.